Hi, and welcome to the Magazine Rack on Chris. I'm Tricia Beatty. Today I'll be reading from the March 25th issue of the Christian Science Monitor. In the limited time we have, I'll read from their section called One Week, which is a series of brief articles and commentary on the top stories of the past few days. 3,000 feet above Gaza Strip. My flight over Gaza in a plane dropping food aid. By Taylor Luck, Special Correspondent. Thousands of pounds of flour, rice, sugar, ready-to-eat chicken, and I flew over Gaza on March 8th. I was the least important cargo, and I stayed aboard the Royal Jordanian Air Force plane. Everything else ended up on the ground. As a journalist, the closest I could get to the war zone was flying over the rubble and ash. It will be weeks before the floating offshore pier that U.S. President Joe Biden announced will be ready to handle aid to Gaza. United Nations trucks, meanwhile, are finding it increasingly difficult and dangerous to navigate Israeli military checkpoints and mobs of looters. So the 9 cargo planes taking part in a daily airdrop were carrying the bulk of the aid that would reach 2.2 million Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. This is thanks to Jordan, a tiny, resource-poor kingdom with barely any water, but lots of heart. A humanitarian provider for Palestinian refugees since 1948, Jordan has been a logistics hub for humanitarian efforts since the Israel-Hamas war erupted. The Jordanian Air Force's recent airdrops into northern Gaza began with one of the first flights overseen by King Abdullah himself. The operation has been bolstered by aircraft from a burgeoning coalition, including Britain, France, the Netherlands, and the United States. To witness a Jordanian drop over Gaza, I drove out to a remote military airfield east of Amman, where sheep outnumber people. Parked on the tarmac, awaiting final Israeli flight clearance, was the fleet providing the day's aid, 4 Jordanian cargo planes and a handful of foreign aircraft, including just 1 U.S. Air Force C-130. I watched as the planes were loaded with crates of rice, sugar, and powdered milk, and packages of ready-to-eat meals of rice and chicken. That was enough to feed just 45,000 people, when over 500,000 Palestinians in Gaza are facing starvation, according to the UN. Altogether, the fleet carried less than 1 truck could have managed. As a lifeline, it is a fraying thread. But the cargo of these 9 C-130s, if landed and distributed properly, could be the difference between life and death for thousands, at least for a few days. It is a huge feeling of responsibility, Jordanian airman Mohammed Garabai told me as he helped load a pallet onto a Jordanian C-130. Cutting that rope and watching the packages drop, it feels good to know that you are helping. We are able to do something to ease the suffering. Jordan's Air Force has been involved in dozens of humanitarian operations in the Middle East and North Africa, most recently in Sudan, an earthquake-struck Turkey. But never before has it been limited to simply parachuting in aid and then returning to base. That is now these Jordanian airmen's daily routine. 30 minutes after takeoff, as we flew over the sea, Loadmaster Saif Zarawi tapped my shoulder, pointed out of the window, and said, "This is Gaza." I saw a Mediterranean coastline that, from a distance, appeared normal. As we got closer and descended to 3,000 feet, however, rubble-strewn plots and crumbling buildings came into view. My thoughts immediately went to my colleague, Ghada Abdul Fattah, in central Gaza, with whom I am in daily contact. The stretching landscape of charred houses and missile craters gave me new insight into the life or death obstacles she faces as she goes about her work. And I was a half mile above her head. I remembered her lack of water, heat, and food, her mother's hunt for medicine. My heart was heavy. I wished impossibly that I could have brought everything in my kitchen and dropped it out of the plane to her. I felt futile at 3,000 feet. As we flew north, the crumbling buildings beneath us gave way to gray and blackened earth, as if a permanent shadow had been cast over Gaza City. Suddenly, it was drop time. Three airmen opened the rear cargo door of the plane, and the two rows of eight parachute-packed cartons slid out neatly, one after the other. Within a few seconds, the drop was done. The loadmaster at the very rear of the plane, nearly dangling out the door, raised a thumbs up in the air. A successful drop. Our plane circled Gaza City to watch the parachute's trajectory. And that was it. There was no clapping nor cheers, no high fives. Just a simple thumbs up and silence to mark another day's work. Tragically, as I discovered when I returned home to Amman, the operation carried a heavy cost. One of the parachutes, it is unclear from which plane, failed to open. The falling pallet of humanitarian supplies killed at least two of the hundreds of people who were racing to the site of the airdrop so as to ensure they got their hands on something to eat. Reports later indicated that the number rose to five. Not the first time, I reflected, the Gaza Strip has proved resistant to good news. Kharkiv, Ukraine. Amid Western aid cuts, Ukraine families wonder how they'll get by. By Scott Peterson, staff writer. A budget crunch has brought new levels of uncertainty to the two cramped rooms of a student dormitory in Kharkiv. There, Ukrainian mother, Ola Poloratska, and her four children have been surviving on monthly payments provided to Ukrainians displaced by the war. For most, those payments are now ending. I can't imagine how I can live without that, says Ms. Poloratska, whose son, Ruslan, is 9 months old, has two teeth, and has a taste for the Ukrainian staple, beetroot borscht. When I heard that news, I was amazed, says the distraught mother. I called my husband and said, "What are we going to do? Join the army to get money?" Ukraine relies on foreign aid for half of its annual budget, and months of continuing delays in American approval of a $60 billion military and support package for Ukraine are cutting deep, from a shortage of artillery shells on the battlefield to severe reduction in services. The European Union in late February passed its own delayed package of $54 billion for Ukraine for 2024 to 2027, which includes some $42 billion in direct budget support. Japan also gave $440 million in the first 2 months of the year, also for budget support. But the uncertain Western cash flow to Ukraine has forced a broad belt tightening, even as Russia's invasion grinds into its third year and Russian forces go on the offensive. Ms. Poloratska first held her breath when Ukraine's cash-strapped government announced that modest support payments to the legions of internally displaced people, IDPs, would end February 1st. For her, that would have meant losing roughly $50 each for her and her two older daughters, and $75 each for her two small children, a total of some $300 per month. They would then have to get by on $120 per month, the official payment to all mothers of four children. The cutoff was delayed until March 1st, but Ms. Poloratska was still holding her breath, unsure if new rules that would continue payments to the most vulnerable people will include her family. Prices are high for everything from diapers to vegetables, which they used to grow for themselves on their own plot in Kucherivka, a battle-scarred town just miles from Ukraine's increasingly noisy northeastern front line. Both sides of her family, for three generations, worked at the nearby railroad hub, which is now destroyed. Ms. Polorotska's husband has stayed in the town, at the edge of territory liberated by Ukraine in a September 2022 counteroffensive, where he does volunteer work with occasional payment as a mechanic fixing military vehicles. Sometimes he comes here, so we don't forget what he looks like, says Ms. Polorotska, who asked that his name not be used for his security. Two rooms in the converted student dormitory hang with drying laundry and are stuffed with cooking tools, a TV, and whatever else could be brought from home. When the Russians were advancing in early 2022, the first shell to land in Kucherivka exploded in their front yard. Last August, after Russia stepped up air attacks on nearby Kupiansk and Ukrainian soldiers warned of the risk to the children, the family finally left for Kharkiv, Ukraine's second-largest city, just 25 miles from the Russian border, and itself a frequent target of rockets and missiles. If we believe what our government says to us, this money will be redirected to the army, says Ms. Polorotska. She is not certain, though, that that is where it goes. Her older daughter, Lisa, had been in contact with a soldier from Lyman who told her that for 3 months in a row, the bulk of his $3,000 monthly salary had been delayed, and that he had instead received a tiny fraction of it. Is this normal? Ms. Polorotska asks. For this family and so many others, the cash for IDPs has been a critical lifeline. How can you leave these people with nothing? Asks Valentina Iritsova, who refurbished this student dormitory after it had been abandoned for 2 years in northwest Kharkiv. She calls the dorm her personal combat zone and says it now accommodates 178 displaced Ukrainians, including 28 children. Donations poured in after the sanctuary was opened to IDPs last August, but they began to dry up in November, says Ms. Iritsova. Most of the temporary residents are retirees who receive a monthly pension of $60, she says, and live on that until the IDP payment comes. That's how it goes, she says. This is crucial money for them. Indeed, Ukrainian officials say that 40% of the displaced people depend entirely on state financial assistance for sustenance. But the cut in IDP payments, which reportedly aims to save $530 million of Ukraine's annual budget, is just one facet of a broader financial shriveling, which partly stems from delayed Western support. Financial aid from the United States is crucial for maintaining macro-financial stability during the war, Ukrainian Finance Minister Sergei Marchenko tweeted in mid-February, after the Senate approved a long-delayed $60 billion aid package for Ukraine, which included $7.85 billion in direct budget support. Still, the House has delayed its own vote, with Republicans tying the issue to domestic immigration measures. In Kharkiv, officials suggest that local budgets may shrink 40% this year. In a region that experienced widespread destruction during the invasion, then months of occupation, and the Ukrainian counteroffensive, rebuilding depends on foreign cash and, of course, the course of the war. Anton Korotovsky, director of the Department of Architecture and City Development for the Kharkiv region, lists a string of projects that have been identified for restoration. But because Kharkiv is so close to the Russian border and there is shelling every day, most of these projects are in the aspirational phase, he says. The main challenge is refurbishing private residences because people want to go back. Last year, some 1,500 buildings, including multi-story residential complexes, were restored. But with 50,000 buildings and homes damaged or destroyed in the region, it is going to be a long job, he says. Of course, the biggest challenge is our big and reckless neighbor, which keeps destroying things, says Mr. Koratovsky. So we focus on critical infrastructure, like heating and electricity. The lack of resources is so profound, for example, that the fund for rebuilding destroyed roads now is zero. There is nothing, he says. We have expectations that this year we will have less for this because we understand that the entire state budget is put into the military. Rebuilding must be done in a holistic way, such that those who might move back to refurbished homes also have schools, hospitals, and other facilities like bomb shelters for children, Mr. Koratovsky adds. Of course, we have our fears about a shrinking or cutoff of Western aid, he says. We can't talk of rebuilding without finance. The Explainer. Why are many top colleges requiring the SAT again? A pandemic-era response to disruptions in college admissions is coming to an end at some of the most highly selective colleges in the United States. Standardized testing largely became optional for admittance during COVID-19 for first-year students in fall 2021. It remains that way at a majority of institutions issuing four-year degrees. But soon it will no longer be optional at schools such as Yale, Dartmouth, Brown, Georgetown, and the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Some think it's a sign of what's to come. In late February, Yale University announced that to be admitted starting in fall 2025, students will have to submit some form of standardized test results. They can choose from traditional SAT or ACT scores, or subject-based scores from advanced placement or international baccalaureate tests. The university says this decision came after a few years of test optional admissions had been shown to hurt low-income students who withheld test scores. Also in February, Dartmouth College announced a return to standardized test admission requirements after school president Sean Baylock ordered an internal study. Dartmouth found that rejected low-income students who omitted SAT scores but scored in the 1400s would otherwise have been admitted. The school would have taken those scores into account had the students reported them. Why has Yale, for example, taken another look at testing? Jeremiah Quinlan, Dean of Undergraduate Admissions at Yale, says that application reviewers and researchers had placed greater weight on other parts of the application for people who applied without submitting test scores. But reviewers noticed it worked to the disadvantage of some applicants. We found that applicants without scores from lower socioeconomic backgrounds were less likely to be admitted than others, because they were less likely to have that evidence in other parts of their applications, says Mr. Quinlan via email. Yale said that it has admitted more than 1,000 applicants who did not submit test scores, and that those students have performed relatively well in their coursework. Where it noticed a difference was in grade point averages, with students who submitted test scores getting better grades than those who did not. What happened when schools went test optional? Highly selective schools at one point experienced a backlash for being sticklers in requiring standardized test scores, as critics noted that those tests favored wealthy students who could afford test preparation classes and tutors to improve their results. Complaints also arose that the tests were culturally biased against students of color and those who didn't speak English as a first language. In 2020, Columbia became the first in the Ivy League to go test optional. That same year, amid the pandemic, some 650 schools in America did likewise. A 2021 study of 99 colleges that went test optional between 2005 and 2006, and between 2015 and 2016, found that this resulted in a 3% to 4% gain in low-income Pell Grant recipients, and a 10% to 12% gain in Black, Latino, and Native American students. But the study's author said there were so few of those students on campuses that the effect of change in campus makeup was more like a 1% gain in Pell Grant recipients and a 1% gain in Black, Latino, and Indigenous students. Individual schools, such as the University of Chicago, which went test optional in 2018, cited broader gains. It saw 20% more first-generation and low-income students the year after it dropped the testing requirement, and rural student admissions spiked 56%. It also saw record classes of Black and Latino students. But dropping the testing requirement came amid a slate of policies designed to diversify enrollment. And the university said the increases could not be attributed solely to dropping the SAT and ACT. In a statement, the College Board, which administers the SAT, said schools requiring the test have done so because research shows that SAT scores are more predictive of college success than are high school grades alone. A growing body of research confirms that the SAT is a valuable, objective measure, useful not just in admissions, but in creating data-driven programs to ensure admitted students get the supports they need to graduate, the organization said. If not tests, then what? Eric Loomis is an associate professor of history and director of graduate studies at the University of Rhode Island, and has written about why standardized testing should return as a metric for admissions. He thinks schools should reinstate standardized testing for equity reasons. It's a sad state of affairs because everybody who says that standardized tests reflect racial inequality, I think they are actually correct. The problem is that everything that replaces that seems to be even worse, Dr. Loomis says. One main culprit is the college essay, he adds. Just as well-resourced families have a leg up for SAT or ACT prep, people can also pay others to teach students to write an effective essay. Those less scrupulous sometimes pay others to write college essays, or experienced adults simply write them for their children. And the people who are just trying to tell their stories, but maybe are coming from a situation in which they are totally brilliant, but they live in Central Falls, Rhode Island, which is an incredibly poor, mostly Colombian and African-American town. Maybe the grammar is not as good, it's not as sharp and polished, but that person might be incredibly brilliant, Dr. Loomis notes. Dr. Loomis says that college admissions committees have realized that people game the system, and that a return to tests might be a little less problematic. He also guesses that highly selective schools are trying to head off potential lawsuits from students not being admitted, while others are under test optional policies. What about public universities? While some highly selective schools have reinstituted test requirements, the University of Michigan, a premier public university, announced in February that it was moving to a permanent test optional policy for 2025. This came after Michigan went test flexible in 2020, accepting SAT, ACT, PSAT, IB, or AP scores. Now, only SAT and ACT scores will be accepted if students choose to submit them. Michigan says this is to provide access to high-achieving students from all backgrounds. Other highly selective schools such as Harvard, Columbia, and the University of Chicago also remain test optional. The University of California suspended all standardized tests for students entering in 2023 and fall 2024. UC is trying to create its own test that aligns with the curriculum taught there. If one isn't created for 2025, UC will eliminate standardized tests for California students. In that regard, Yale and Dartmouth look like outliers. It's definitely not a harbinger, says Bob Schaefer, Director of Public Education for the National Center for Fair and Open Testing. There are nearly 2,300 four-year colleges in the U.S., and the fact that a handful have reverted to requiring testing, when more than 1,700 are permanently test optional or test blind, is a minor development. He says that although a small number of schools have concluded that test scores have some value in the admissions process, in the end, the proof will be in the numbers. He will be looking to see if diversity declines or if academic performance changes, he says. Research dating to 1969, when Bowdoin College in Maine became the first school to go test optional, overwhelmingly points to more applications and stronger applicants in terms of grade point averages and academic rigor, Mr. Schaefer says. You get more diversity of all sorts, race, family income, first generation, immigrants, etc. Numbers in the news. 2,142. Value in dollars per ounce of gold as of early March, a record high. Gold is used to store value during periods of instability and has risen over $300 per ounce since the start of the Israel-Hamas war. Experts predict it will continue to rise in the next fiscal quarter. 197. People exonerated while on death row with evidence of their innocence since the death penalty was reinstated in the United States in 1973. 700. Languages, at least, spoken in New York City. Of these, 150 or more are listed as endangered. In Queens, more languages are spoken per square mile than anywhere else in the world, according to linguists. 500. Women who have died in Kenya from gender-related violence from 2016 to 2023, according to Kenyan research firm Odipo Dev. Thousands of protesters marched in Kenya in January to demand that the government establish femicide as a crime distinct from homicide. 7,300. Men in Bogota, Colombia, who have completed in-person courses on housework and childcare. The free, city-funded classes cover subjects such as changing a diaper, styling hair into a ponytail, and washing dishes. 2. Thirds of Americans who would choose to eliminate daylight saving time changes completely, according to a poll by The Economist and YouGov. Over two dozen states have introduced legislation to end the time switches, but only Arizona and Hawaii have permanently opted out. That's it for this installment of the Magazine Rack. I've been reading from the March 25th issue of the Christian Science Monitor. I'm Tricia Beattie. So long for now.